So welcome to this morning's talk. And first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about walking meditation, and then afterwards to talk something about giving a little bit of warmth in the beginning of the meditation in order just to get it started. It's 3 full days have gone past, and so most of you, not all of you, would have overcome a lot of the tiredness, settled in to the retreat center. You know, you've got used to your room, the room's got used to you, you know how things work. And also, hopefully, the mind has settled down. Maybe not settled down as much as you want, because it doesn't go according to what you want. It always goes according to nature, according to causes and conditions. It's settling down more and more. And on that, sometimes you really can't tell how much it's settled down until actually you leave this place. And it's a credible thing that some people think, oh, not really good meditation, they haven't settled down that much. But it's incredible when they actually leave and just go out into the world outside and the traffic and the people, you actually really realize just how much you've settled down and how much you've become calm. There was one person here on the Rains retreat, the 3-month retreat, which is very hard to get into. And she was telling me, oh, meditation's not going so well, I haven't got very peaceful, I don't know what I'm doing. And I sent her into only just a local town, Armidale, to go into a shopping center. And she went into the shopping center one afternoon, she came back and said, that's crazy in there. I used to live in those places, and now I can realize actually how much I have calmed down. Because you're here, you've got nothing really to compare your state of mind with, except the people sitting next to you, and everyone has calmed down. So, believe it or not, you've actually settled down quite a lot. But in order to enhance that, we're now going to talk about some walking meditation, and you see the way this retreat center has been designed. This center was designed especially for retreats. That's why we've got 3 rooms, one to my left, one to my right, one to the back, for walking meditation. So you don't have to go a long distance to actually to change from sitting to walking. And you also notice these little carpets, and actually they're yoga mats, you know, on there chosen, so they're not too soft, not too hard, they're comfortable to walk on. And the reason we have those mats in there, because if we didn't put the mats in there, there'd be some Jojo decides to walk diagonally, backwards and forwards, so no one else can use those. It's in people's nature. They can't use that room. So by putting hard concrete, cold, as deliberately put there, cold and hard, and the mats in between, we're actually channeling people. That is where you walk. You don't walk on the concrete. And number 2, in order to encourage the walking meditation, they are red carpets. One of them was orange because the shop ran out of red, but that's the color I wanted. This is red carpet walking meditation. So, first of all, you've got the places to do it. You don't have to do the walking meditation in those rooms, but they're there for you. You can actually just use some of the walkways, you know, in this center. There's lots of covered walkways. Or you can go out into the forest if you like to do some walking meditation. Or, you know, if you don't want to do sort of backwards and forwards walking meditation, you go round and round in circles around the stupas. There's so many areas there where you can do some walking meditation. Now, unfortunately, you can't do the walking meditation on the lawn because those kangaroos, 4 of them there last night. There's all kangaroo poo over everywhere. But anyway, they're happy. So the places you can do the walking meditation. Now, how you do the walking meditation? In some traditions, you are meant, encouraged, taught to walk slowly. You don't have to walk slowly. Keep it natural. Because I've seen this in those meditation retreats when people walk really slowly. There's 2 people in the hall, and it's a competition who can walk the slowest. And they're looking around, she's walking really slow, I better slow down. This is no competition. You don't look at anybody else. You know, you're just being aware, you know, of yourself walking. And anyway, it was about a year ago now that there was another retreat on here, because it's not just my retreat, it opened up to any Buddhist tradition. And they were doing a retreat here, and they were doing walking meditation according to the slow walking meditation method. And it had some visitors came. And they came to have a look. They realized the retreat was coming on, so they turned around and went back again. Because, you know, we do have visitors come here. Please excuse them. They're trying to be quiet. They're just having a look around. So, you know, they shouldn't be too disturbing. But anyway, with them was a little kid. And the kid came to me at dawn time. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, there's a problem. I said, what's the problem? Ajahn Brahm, in your retreat center, there's zombies. There's zombies. Because that's what it looked like, you know, walking really slowly. And apparently so many zombie movies these days that he saw the meditators were a bunch of zombies. So to this day I call slow walking meditation zombie meditation. So keep it natural. So by keeping it natural, you just walk. And if it's in here, you start at one end, go to the other end, come back again. If it's over in the round the stupas, obviously you go round and round. Try and find a nice path. Not too short, not too long. If it's too short, you're always turning around. You're not really walking too long. And sometimes your mindfulness is not strong enough that you start to wander off. Because when you stop and turn around, it helps you stop your mind. So that's why sometimes walking backwards and forwards is the help. Round and round and round, you can wander in your mind round and round and round. But when you actually go to the end of a path, you stop physically. That helps your mind stop and actually get some peace again. So those are the best ones. A path, and then you walk backwards and forwards. For those of you who've seen my cave, you can see the walking meditation outside my cave. So it's right outside. That's what I do. Nice and comfortable. It's obviously here you take your shoes off. If you're walking around the stupa or on the paths, it's great to take your shoes off. But, you know, I don't hardly wear my shoes at all here. This is very clean. It's not like Bangkok. It's not like Jakarta. You know, it's really clean, this place. So you don't actually need to wear shoes. And, you know, you walk around on the paths without any shoes on. You look at your feet afterwards. They hardly need to be dusted. It's a very clean environment here. So, but especially when you're doing walking meditation, take your shoes off and take your socks off so, you know, you can actually feel the ground. Because the idea is to get some awareness going. I'm really concerned that in our modern age, we are so divorced from nature that we know we don't feel cold, we don't feel heat anymore. You know, we wear shoes and socks and hats and gloves, which means we're not really alive anymore. So if you really want to be aware, then, you know, take off all the jackets and just feel the cold. You're not going to get sick. This is not the Arctic. You know, this is just, you know, Australia in just the, what is it now, the autumn time. So it's, you know, it's mild. You might feel a little bit cold, but you'll find feeling cold is actually making you alive. You're actually feeling something. You're getting into your body. Especially if you think too much. Think. Feeling is a much better way of overcoming the thought. You're actually alive. You're feeling the cold, feeling the hot, feeling the wind. This morning and last night was really windy. And I was just out there, just around the stupa, just feeling the wind on your face. It's a beautiful feeling. And you're coming alive. You're in the moment. Nature gets you into this present moment. So if it's in the paved areas, take your shoes off and socks off. Take your hats off, feel a bit of cold. And if it's even hot, feel the sun on you. Feel hot as well. Now, obviously not for too long. You get skin cancer and all those other things. But at least feel, instead of always sort of insulating yourself. If it does rain, go out there and get wet. I mean, when was the last time you got soaking wet? We have umbrellas. We run away from these things. You can actually get really soaking wet, then go to your room, have a shower, dry off, and then change your clothes. Why not? Because you're becoming alive again, being mindful. And unfortunately, you did that as a kid. And it was really great fun. Jumping in the puddles, getting soaking wet, and actually feeling your body. I often see on some of these events the children do this skin painting. You know, when they sort of paint all stuff over their skin. And the reason they love that is because they love actually just being touched and just feeling just the tactile sensations of a brush or a marker pen just on their skin. They're becoming alive. And this is one thing we can do with walking meditation. You know, just don't just insulate yourself so much. And when you do walking meditation in these rooms, you know, with your bare feet, it doesn't really matter where you put your hands. You can put them where they're comfortable. Just like you're meditating, you start there. Where's the most comfortable position? It seems good enough. And wherever you want to do your walking meditation, that's how you do it. And you just walk naturally, you know, from one end to the other end. Now, if there's anyone here from Germany, because if you're from Germany, then the way they do a walking meditation over there is up, down, up, down. Just like in the Third Reich. I get into big trouble when I say things like that. Or, if you're Australian, how many people were born in Australia? Great, so your walking meditation, you put your... Yeah, please. That's right. What is it? Kangaroo walking meditation. No, it's whatever you want to do. So you just walk naturally, as you were just walking from one place to another. Present moment awareness. So, don't worry where you're getting to. That's the nice thing, as I mentioned earlier. You don't get anywhere when you're walking meditation. Now, you walk backwards and forwards. You haven't got a destination. Because there's so many things we do in this life is always to get something. And the journey is not important. It's just the goal is important. The outcomes are the most important, not the process. Walking meditation is a process. It's how we're walking, not where we're going to. So it brings you right back into the present moment. And when you're walking, especially in these halls, you know, we try and keep this as boring as possible. See these bricks over there? It's all the same. We got no paintings or murals on this place on purpose. Because that you've got nothing to look at except just being. So there's nothing really to watch in those rooms. So you have to just watch yourself instead. So you're just walking there, nothing much to think about. Of course, you know, people can get in their fantasy worlds, planning, working out the business plan for the next year, worrying about what happened. You can even walk in those paths, working out the meaning of life, and that's just as stupid. So don't philosophize and work out the deeper meaning of the Four Noble Truths. That is rubbish. Just be quiet and calm. So number one, you just present moment awareness. And number two, learn how to be silent. Just to walk without a thought going on in your mind. So just be in this moment. Try to be silent. When you're aware of this inner commentary, you know, you can actually just see just what a waste of time it is. And in order to stop that inner commentary, as I already mentioned to you, to notice the spaces between the words. Also, see if you can notice the space between the observer and the thoughts. It's another way of overcoming the thinking mind. Space between the thoughts and the observer. Just like all these words coming out now, they're coming out of this mouth, and you're sitting over there. There's a space between you and the teacher, which means you know you can turn off if you wish to. And getting a space between you and the thoughts is a great skillful means of letting go of thinking. And the simile is, which I've noticed, and you've noticed this as well, when people watch, say, cricket matches. There's a few Sri Lankans here and they just had World Cup cricket. And if you don't like cricket, if you're from Malaysia and Singapore, soccer matches. If you're a person who doesn't like sport at all, you like movies, it's exactly the same phenomena. I remember seeing this, the one event I remember, when I was a student, going with my mates to go and see like movies, and I remember the horror movie, Tarantula. I still remember this. There was a small spider, a tarantula, got involved in a nuclear accident, mutated and became this huge monster. You know, it's a stupid plot for the movie. And the tarantula was creeping up behind people and eating them. But there's one thing I've noticed in horror movies. The monsters, especially things like tarantulas, they only attack the beautiful girls. The ugly old fat ones, they leave alone. So if you're ugly, old and fat, you don't have to worry about monsters. They never go for you. You always have to be some hot chick. That's what they go for. And anyway, there is a movie there, this beautiful girl there, and the tarantula is creeping up behind. And it always happened every time that somebody in the audience would shout out, "Hey, look out behind you, tarantula's coming." And you'd crack up laughing. It's a movie, and it was shot in Hollywood about 10 years ago. No, tarantula can't hear you. And that's exactly what happens in a TV. You know, there's a soccer match. Come on, shoot, shoot, shoot. Offside, ref, offside. There wasn't a goal. And it's being played 3,000 miles away. And it's a recording anyway. It's already finished. Doesn't matter how loud you shout in Singapore. They cannot hear you in Manchester. But people still do that. And to me, it was the psychology of that. Why do people do that? Why do you cry and get excited when you're watching a movie? Why do you get involved when somebody is bowling a ball in a cricket match and you're watching it in Perth and it's happening in New Zealand? It's because when you watch that TV set, you literally get sucked in. You can't see the edges of the screen. And you'll get confused. Your brain gets confused to think you're right there next to the field on the sidelines and you can be heard. When you're watching the movie, it literally sucks you in. The psychology perception is you are right there in the movie. You are on the sidelines. You are actually watching, just out of shot, but you're watching there and you can actually see the person falling in love, and you get emotional. Oh, it's so sweet. You literally are part of the action. You're part of the film. You're part of the soccer match or the cricket match. That is why people shout. And that's a very simple observation to make, but I've used that common occurrence to understand why we get sucked into thinking. The thinking is a fantasy. It's a dream. Even your past and future. The future is obviously a fantasy, but the past is also a fantasy too. And you ask any psychologist what you think happened, probably never did happen. You recreate the past every time you think about it, which is one of the reasons why when people ask what had happened, and you get a recording of it, and you find, crikey, I was wrong. And you really believe you are right. We recreate the past according to our what we want it to be. Which is one of the reasons why we argue so much about who did what. You did. I didn't do that. Yes, you did. I was there at the time. But I was there at the time as well. I never said that. Yes, you did. We have arguments because no one can know. Because we do change the past. That's part of the psychology of memory. It is very, very uncertain. I remember just reading an article, traffic cops know that. There's been an accident, a collision, and they have to interview the witnesses. And the poor old policeman, it was only 5 minutes ago, and then there was a red car, and the witness said, no, it was a white car. We change our memories, and so it gets really, really difficult for policemen investigating an accident to actually know what really happened. That's why cameras are just so helpful. Cameras do have good memory. We don't. So understanding that just means you can't rely on your memory. It too is uncertain, just as your future. But just like the movie, we get sucked into it and believe it. And that's why we have these emotional responses which keep the past and the future and the thoughts going. Now, if we can put some space between us and the thoughts, it's like remembering, it's a soccer match on the TV. I'm in my room in Malaysia or in Jakarta, and you know, I'm sitting on the chair. It's on the screen. There's a space between us. I am not, you know, on the sidelines of that match. Then you don't shout. You know, you were watching a movie. I'm in the seat in the cinema. The movie's on this big screen, but I'm on the seat. Something gets blown up. I'm not going to get blown up. If somebody dies, they get, as I keep on saying, they get reincarnated in the next showing of the movie. They're alive again. I put some space between me and the movie, which means I don't get emotionally entangled. If you put some space between you and your thoughts, you don't get entangled, which means the thoughts do not last that long. If you could only see how stupid the movie is, you'd soon turn it off. I did that once. I was on a flight somewhere, don't take the headphones. And didn't take the headphones. And you know, the screen comes down. It's on the old times when we had the screen coming down. And you could not look at it unless you close your eyes. It was right in front of you. So I was just looking at this. And it was apparently a movie called Armageddon. And it was really, it was a comedy if you didn't have the sound. It was really, I was laughing my head off. I think the people sitting next to me thought I was a bit weird, but they looked at how I was dressed, and so it was consistent. Because I was laughing when everyone else was on the edge of their seat. And I remember the scenes. I think they put these spacecraft out into space because a comet was about to hit the Earth and smash the Earth into two. And these tough guys had to go out there and blow up the comet so it wouldn't hit the Earth or something. And so they went in one of these space shuttles or something or other, spacecraft. And one of them was, you know, obviously out of control. It smashed into the comet. And there was flames and sparks everywhere. I couldn't hear the sound because I didn't have the headphones. There was pyrotechnics. And it was about 2 or 3 minutes rolling over everywhere, crash here, smash there, and then it fell over a cliff, and more smashes and crashes, and about 5 or 10 minutes. Now, you know, some of you have seen road accidents, just one few seconds, and it kills everybody. But for this, 5 or 6 minutes of absolute mayhem, and when it got quiet, you saw this hand came up above an edge. And then the hero pulled himself up, hair perfect, perfectly coiffed, not even a bead of sweat on him, no bruises, no cuts, no blood, perfect, like he'd just come out of, you know, the salon to get his hair done. I burst out laughing. It was just so ridiculously funny. And everyone else went, oh, he made it, he survived. What a stupid movie that is. So if you ever want to have fun, you know, when you go back, those of you travelling after this retreat, look at the movie, but turn the sound off. Put the headphones away. And watch a movie without the headphones. And it is ridiculous. The plot is so predictable. You know, because you've seen that, I've seen, I look at the magazines, there have all these superheroes. Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Copper Man, whatever, I don't know what else you've got here. You know the plot. Same plot as when I used to read the comics when I was a kid. There's some evil genius. And there's only one person, just one person is not, you know, not really supposed to do anything. He's usually been kicked out of the police force. Or is, you know, some loner or some freak. And he saves everybody. But only at the last moment. Only at the very, very last moment saves someone. There's always a girl involved. She usually gets captured by the bad guy and he rescues her and blah, blah, blah. And in the end, they meet together.
It's always the same movie. But what are you watching it for? You know how it's going to end. They're going to save. The world is going to be saved. But only at the last moment. So you can just fast forward to the last moment. Oh, it's well saved. Then you can go and have a nice meditation instead of watching the movie. But we like to get involved in it. And it's exactly why we like to get involved in thoughts. The same thing. The same psychology. So if you want to let go of thoughts, put space between you and the thoughts. So you get perspective. You get like an objective to see. What you actually see, there's all these thoughts, 99.9% of them are just pretty stupid and hopeless and a waste of time. You take away the emotional involvement and entanglement with your thinking process and you put space between you and the thoughts. Tough thing to do because you're used to actually getting right involved in the thoughts. But if you can imagine the thoughts are out there and I'm the watcher, the observer, I'm distant from it. And then you can actually have perspective. And the thoughts don't last that long. So that's what you can do in the walking meditation. Yeah, you've got thoughts, but you know, put the thoughts in front of you, a thought or two. And then you find they soon disappear. And you replace them by just these amazing just feelings of walking. Because you're doing something simple, you're just walking backwards and forwards, you're not having to worry where you're going to go, where you're going to turn, should I go this way or that way, because it's simple, decided. So the end and back again, end and back again. There's no choices, there's no point to thinking, which means that you soon calm down, you become more mindful. Remember teaching? Yeah, we all know we should be mindful, but how do you become mindful? Or in Buddhism, what is the cause for mindfulness? Because we always have in this Buddhist general philosophy or general ways of looking at life. Causes and effect, causes and effect. If you want that effect, find out what the cause is. And then when you put that cause into place, you get the effect. If you have an effect you don't like too much thinking, what's the cause of too much thinking? So you look at the causes, not the effect. Just like in medicine, you know, you've got a fever, you don't try and suppress the fever. What's the cause of that fever? Find out what the cause is. When you find out what the cause is, then the effect disappears. So what is the cause of mindfulness? And it is stillness. You could experiment with that during this retreat. The more still you are, the more you relax, the more calm, the more awake you are, the more aware you are. Okay, story which I usually say on every retreat, here it comes. The road going up from the highway up to Jhana Grove, or up to Bodhinyana Monastery. You've been up that hill at least once, that's why you're here. Now remember, I live up here, and for this is 31, 32 years now, I think, Bodhinyana Monastery. And for the first 7 years living up at Bodhinyana Monastery, I'd always go up and down that hill in a car. Never once walking. It's a steep hill. And there's always no people. They always say, Ajahn Brahm, we'll give you a lift. Ajahn Brahm, don't walk, we'll give you a lift. That's why I'm fat. It's not my fault, it's your fault. But you just will not let me walk. Even when I go on the afternoon and walk back to Bodhinyana Monastery, it's not that far, and people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I give you a lift? Can I give you a lift? Leave me alone. You know, sometimes you like exercise, honestly. But anyway, so there we are. I was 7 years up and down that hill in a car, and one day I came back early, and it was one of these beautiful, sunny spring days. Not hot, not cold, and really, really nice, and plenty of time. And I told the driver, let me off at the bottom of the hill, I'm going to walk up. Of course, he said, no, I can't do that, you're Ajahn Brahm. He said, let me off. He said, no, no. He said, let me off. So after arguing with him, he let me out. It's really difficult. Now there we go, let out. It's just like in Singapore, you know, sometimes I say, why can't I get on the train, MRT, you know, to go from Buddhist Fellowship over to the airport? You know, the train goes right to the airport. Oh no, we can't let you go in the train. You've got to go in the car. He said, okay, well, you've got that sort of, in Indonesia. So we can't let you go in the car, too much traffic. Okay, motorbike. We can't have Ajahn Brahm going in the back of a motorbike. So it was really difficult, anyway. But anyway, this time I managed to get out of the car and walk up the hill. It's only 2.2 kilometers, that's all, not that far. We've got plenty of time. So I was happily walking up the hill, you know, just for a little exercise and recreation. But it was a wonderful experience because I got a great insight on that walk, which I share with everybody. Because as I was walking, just looking at the scenery around me, I could not recognize that hillside. It looked absolutely 100% different than how I remembered seeing it through the window of a car. And you know, when these things happen, you know, you think, well, what's going on here? Now, I've been living here for 7 years at the time. Up and down maybe 2-3 times a week on average. Surely I could recognize my surroundings. When I was walking, it would look totally different. And it was so surprising, I just stopped, had plenty of time, stopped and stared. And then it changed again. And it looked so beautiful when I stood still. And I saw things I'd never, ever noticed before. You know, right in the bottom of the valley was a little creek. And all these little rocks and boulders and little flowers and bushes, which I'd never noticed before. And even I always remember the bark on the trees were just delightful. And everything was just, the other strange thing, the grass was greener. You know, the rocks, you know, were more grey. And I thought, what's going on? And, of course, I had a science background. And so I soon figured out what was happening. It was nature, that's all. When you see something, light hits the back of your eye, the retina, and it makes a chemical reaction. And that chemical reaction takes time for it to properly form. But when I'm looking through the window of a car, I'm only going 40, 50, 60 kilometers an hour, but that's enough. Light hits the back of the eye. Before the image is properly formed, another image comes up, and then another image, and then another image. No image ever fully forms. Which means that, you know, it's all smeared and gray and pastel. But when I got out and walked, I had more time. So the images went to the back of the eye, they formed more fully. So it was deeper colors, more detail in the image which was on my retina, which my mind could then explore. I was literally seeing more. And I'd never seen these things before. Because my mind or my eye never had time to see them. And then when I stood still, that was the very, very best. Because then, only then, the eye had all the time it needed to see the full image. All the detail could actually emerge and see these little flowers and rocks and pebbles and everything. It was a full image. And also, the colors were rich, as they should be. But, you know, when you don't have enough time, just the things in the retina don't have the time to fully make the image. So what you actually see is pastel, washed out, not the full, like, you know, you have a like a red dress, you've washed it so many times that most of the colour is washed out and it's just all pinky. It hasn't got the deep colours when you first bought the dress. That's what I was seeing most of the life. But now I was still, and the full redness, incredible deep fluorescent green of the grass. And I realize that's a great simile for mindfulness and stillness. Much of people's life is seen through the window of a speeding car. I don't mean sort of specifically, I mean metaphorically. We go so fast in our life, running around from one thing to the next, because we have to, we've got hardly any choice. And because of that, now our senses don't pick up the full image of life. And also, life is washed out. But when you slow down, you pick up more. You literally see more. The food. I always mention this. Bianca's just come in. You know, people say, oh, Bianca, she's such a great cook. She is a good cook. But by the end of the retreat, she'll be a wonderful cook. And please, I apologize, Bianca, it's nothing to do with you. It's because your mindfulness gets so strong that, you know, all those flavors which were there at the beginning, now you can really taste them. And instead of being like washed out or insipid, they're really full flavors. Now, I realized this. I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, after meditating for years, you look back and you understand what's happening. My first meditation retreat was in 1971, and that was in Cambridge, in Bateman Street. Still remember the name of the road, it was close to the Botanical Gardens. And the meditation group there, it was held in not nice retreat centres like this, it was in the boarding houses for students during the vacation period. You know, students had gone home, so they had cheap accommodation and cheap food. Now, there's one thing which especially England was famous for in those days. Actually, probably better to call it infamous for. It's cuisine. It was, for anyone of you who went to college in those days in England, that it was the standard meal was meat and two veg. And the vegetables were boiled and boiled and boiled until there was no flavour left at all. That's why you had to put things like gravy and sauce, any sauce on there, because there's no taste. Now, when it came to boarding houses for poor students, that was the lowest of the low when it came to cooks and chefs. And I knew that. And that was the one thing I was scared of at the retreat. Meditating for hours, you know, I could do that. You know, just being in a room keeping 8 precepts, that's easy enough. The one thing I was worried about, oh God, the food, this is going to be disgusting. Can I last 9 days? But to my great surprise, the food on this retreat was absolutely delicious. And I really thought at the time, you must have struck lucky. Good karma, got the one and only cook in all the boarding houses of England who could actually make something delicious. It's only later on you realize it's nothing to do with the cook. Because my awareness, my meditation was really taking off. My mindfulness was so strong that even the last infinitesimal bit of taste after all that boiling, I could pick up. I could pick up the last little bit of flavor because I was really mindful. And that's why it felt delicious. Because when your mindfulness is strong, you actually pick up things much more. You're slower, more still, and just like that hillside, it's absolutely gorgeous and beautiful. And this is why stillness is the cause for mindfulness. You go slow, you see more, you feel more, you taste more, and in insight you know more. And when you're walking meditation, you start to feel more of the muscles, the sensations in your feet as you're walking. It's incredible to think you can spend an hour, 2 hours walking, totally engrossed in all the myriad of billions of different feelings in walking. People think, this is boring, you're walking backwards and forwards, doing nothing, can I put on my iPod and just listen to some Dhamma or listen to some music or listen to anything? Listen to your feet. Because after a while, when the mind settles down, not so much thinking, you can actually feel the feet moving. And one step is not just left-right. You start to notice the first part of your foot which leaves the ground. Which is it? And which is, when you finish your step, which is the first part which actually touches the ground? What does it feel like to the ground? It's an incredible sensation. You're so alert and sensitive. because your mindfulness is really great. And just one movement of a leg as it moves forward. Do you go straight up, horizontal down? You know, my foot rather goes back a little bit and then goes up and out and then goes down. A little bit backwards. Find out how your foot moves. You don't make it unnatural. You let the natural walking occur and you're just watching it. And all these incredible muscles are needed just to have one step. I know people who make robots, I remember them saying that's one of the hardest things for them to learn how to make a robot walk. And anyone who's had any sort of injury and has to learn how to walk again, say you've had a stroke, it's one of the most difficult things to do. You know, you see babies learn how to walk, and they keep on falling over, but you know, they eventually do it. But you know, to understand what walking is, it's an incredible complex process. And when you're actually just doing this walking meditation, you can feel all of that. And it becomes fascinating. All the different muscles which have to move. And that is meaning you're getting mindful. Still, seeing more, feeling more. And you get to the end of the, okay, turn around, let's do this again. And it becomes fascinating and actually joyful. Yeah? I don't care what my brain is up to. I'm down here watching the feet. There's a few neurons, but it's the neurons of feelings. This, look, as far as the brain is concerned, I don't mind talking about neuroscience a little bit. But there's many things I know that neuroscience is only a fraction of the truth. And I always like quoting Professor John Lauber from Sheffield University. I think this was 1991, it's a bit old now. But he was this professor who shook up neuroscience more than anybody else, and people have never ever managed to actually explain what he found out. Because he was this guy, he was studying the shape of human skulls and how that impacted upon sociology, neurology, because many people's skulls are deformed. You know, when you are born, sometimes you use forceps as you pull the baby out of the mother's womb. And there's damage done sometimes. And so that he would watch out in the campus of Sheffield University, any student whose skull was a bit deformed, to see if that had any lasting effect on their intelligence, emotional stability, whatever. That was his field of research. And one day he noticed one student who was graduate in mathematics, doing PhD work in math. Brilliant guy. And his skull was slightly deformed. And he agreed to go on this program. And they gave him a CT scan of his brain, first of all. And that was when, as they say, you know, the shit hit the fan. There was no brain there. He became known as the boy with no brain, according to Professor Lauber. That's what he called it. No brain. Just cerebral fluid. No way. It was actually, to be accurate, there was 1% of the cortex which would be expected, just a film on the outside. Everything else was cerebral fluid. No way, because the plasticity of the brain theory, could that remnant account for all the higher brain functions of right memory. He should have been a vegetable. He actually shouldn't have even survived that long. But there he was, mature, already getting a first class honours in maths and now doing research work. Totally, they said he was so normal, having a nice steady relationship with a girlfriend, perfectly healthy, that his normality was a bit abnormal, because it's always something wrong with somebody, having a bit of problem here, problem there. But he was actually perfectly well adjusted, which was quite abnormal in a university. But there he was, a boy with no brain. No one can explain exactly what's going on. So there's actually no neurons firing in that guy, at least nowhere enough to actually to survive. But there he was, having a great night. I love science like that, which totally overturns everything. I'm always like a rebel. I like being a rebel. You know, it's one of my goals in life. I shouldn't say this, but okay. One of my goals in life would be excommunicated. So I tick that box. At least it means you're changing things, making it better. So anyway, let's go back to, where was I talking about? When you're just feeling the beautiful, that there's a few neurons firing when you're experiencing the feelings in the feet, but you're not thinking. You're knowing. And you know, when I did that space between thoughts exercise, to show you can know without giving things a name. So, you're feeling the movement of the feet, you can feel it. And it becomes quite absorbing. And when I used to do this in Thailand, this gives an idea of where you actually get to with this walking meditation. I used to, first year in Bangkok, you had to go to do some morning chanting, and then before lunch, you know, I did an hour's walking meditation. And the hall was maybe about 20 meters long, and it took me an hour to go from one end and back again. That's all I did, because I was naturally very slow. And I knew that because you could hear they had, I don't know why they have this, grandfather clocks were all the rage in the temples. And so, you know, just like in Big Ben, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. And you know whether it's quarter past or half past. So that was how I could find out the time. And it was half an hour one way, half an hour the other way, 20 meters. And I was really enjoying myself, just watching the feet move and just incredible sensations. It wasn't forced at all, just quite natural. Just, you know, looking down, you look down on the ground about 2 meters in front of you. You know, don't close your eyes, you know, just half close your eyes if you want to, but just keep it natural, 2 meters in front of you. That gives you the idea of safety. So you're not going to bump into a wall, you're not going to trip over anything. In a place like Thailand, there's no snakes in front of you, so you feel very safe. You know, you can see 2 meters in front of you, that's all. Not left, not right, just 2 meters in front. That's where you're going to walk, that's the area of safety. So I was quite happy just looking down there, just enjoying the incredible feelings in the feet. And then I heard a sound. Come along, soul. Come along, soul. I heard a sound. I didn't know where it was coming from. It was like in the distance. And then I realized it was this monk right in my ear, shouting at me. And I had to go to a dana, a blessing that morning. I'd forgotten all about it. And he'd been sent to come and get me. But I remember this. It's great because he was shouting at me, and for me, I was so into the meditation. It was like millions of miles away. But you know, I heard it, and I realized, oh, yeah, I've got to go to a dana. But I couldn't move. You know, you're so still. And I started, you know, as if someone's talking to you, you know, have to make eye contact. Have a look at them. And I started moving my head. It's amazing, moving the head, all the muscles which you could feel as your head was moving. And I just could not move fast. And it took a couple of minutes, literally, until, you know, I'm going really fast now, until I looked at him and said, what? I was just so peaceful and so calm and so still. It really was hard to actually to get everything rolling again so I could actually be like a normal human being. But I remember that experience because, you know, could see just where I was at and had to come out very quickly. Just how peaceful you can become doing walking meditation. And that peace is so beautiful and joyful. You can really get into it down there, just really peacefully walking, totally immersed in this little bubble of mindfulness just in your feet. And it's not boring at all. It's really fun. And some people, they get so good at the walking meditation, they prefer walking meditation and sitting meditation. That becomes their vehicle. Other people, they prefer sitting meditation, but for most people, you do both. You're sitting meditation, get a bit tired or a bit sort of sore, get up and do walking meditation. And it doesn't matter how long, when you've had enough, then you go down to sit meditation. You become really mindful, very calm, very peaceful. Have a beautiful time. Now, the other thing with this, you see, becoming aware of physical feelings in the body, I wanted to introduce now, before it's too late, is when you do your sitting meditation. Now, I've told you from the beginning, just do nothing, just sit here and just be kind, be sort of aware, that's all you need to do. Kindness is not that hard, the awareness is the hard part because you tend to just wander away. So when I teach my guided meditations in Perth, and I developed, and it's actually what I do naturally, is when you close your eyes, first of all, choose, do something, okay? I'm breaking, you know, the usual way I teach, but it helps. Choose to be aware of your body when you start meditating. So don't go around planning or thinking or watching your breath, just your body. Number one, how am I sitting? Am I comfortable? You know, or do I need to sort of move my back, get another cushion under here? Stretch the back. How's my hands? Do I need to scratch anything? Cough. And especially coughing. Because there's something I've noticed on meditation retreats, and I've even given it a name. It's called volcano effect. Exactly. Because what happens? Sometimes people, when they sit in a room with others, naturally you don't want to disturb others. You've got compassion, you've got no wisdom. So you want to cough and say, no, I better not cough, I'll disturb someone. So I'm not going to cough. You plug it in, just like volcano. I'm not going to cough. I really want to cough, but I'm not going to cough. Like a volcano, it's going to blow. You know it's going to blow eventually. And when it does blow, it's a huge noise. They can hear it in the kitchen. And also, just like a volcano, it's why I call it volcano effects, huge noise, and it sprays all this unhealthy stuff over anyone within a few meters of you. That's really not the way. A little cough now means you stop the volcano effect. So if you need to cough, just cough. It's done with, and it's, you know, it saves a huge explosion later on. So you look out for your body, make sure it's nice and comfortable first of all. So to be able to do that, you are practicing some mindfulness. You're aware of your body, feelings which are always happening right now. Feelings don't leave an imprint on the memory usually, unless they're very intense. They always happen right now. So the feelings in the body, first of all, you can feel, how am I sitting? I know this is important to you, because if you're going to sit for half an hour, 45 an hour, or even longer, you better get yourself comfortable to begin with. Otherwise, you're going to be in pain, or you're going to have to move. So you can see the purpose of this. So you're sitting down. Now, how am I feeling? Is my body comfortable? Do I need to move? Do I need to adjust? So you make all these adjustments. And I sometimes do this for about 3 or 4 minutes. Adjusting, coughing, scratching, just getting myself really comfortable. Because it's not just preparing the body. It's preparing mindfulness and kindness. And some people have asked last night, what is kindness? Kindness is looking at your body, and if it needs to move, moving it. It's actually noticing you've got an itch in your throat, coughing. That's kindness. You know, your chin is itchy, scratching. That's kindness. Not control, but kindness. And if you need to sort of move because my foot is being squashed, I move my foot. So you're actually practicing awareness and kindness from the very beginning by adjusting your body. And once your body is adjusted, then you don't give up on your body yet. You're still aware of the feelings in the body. There may be something like, yeah, just my colon is a bit tight right now. So I can feel that sensation. Aware of that sensation, and I give it kindness. And the sensation relaxes. That's how you know it's kindness. Because it eases, it expands. The pain, the irritation, whatever it is, lessens. That's the effect of kindness. Everything relaxes and eases off. Anger, force, makes you more tense. Can you feel it begin tense now? So you know these things by their effect on your body. And so you practice the awareness of the body and the kindness of the body. You can feel things relaxing, opening up, feeling really good. And that's sometimes what I teach in the body sweeping. But you don't actually, body sweeping is a bit too complicated. I just look at my body, you know, what is the most obvious feeling in my body right now? And it's usually some irritation or pain. And then I go to that, I'm aware of it, and I give it kindness, awareness and kindness, and the whole thing just relaxes and eases. And that's one of the reasons I'm healthy. That's how you can overcome that food poisoning. Because I can relax all parts of my body. You know, I can see just the cold, I can relax it. Because you learn how to do that. Mindfulness gives you feedback, and the kindness is actually what relaxes it. And so the whole feeling just relaxes and relaxes. You relax it away. And this is really good teachings, because when I go to the Cancer Support Association every year, and they come here, I forget the next time they come in, a couple of months I think, and I teach them this relaxation of their breasts to avoid breast cancer. And what, relax your breast? How on earth can you do that? Yeah, I can relax my back. I can relax my legs. I give my foot massage. How can you relax your breasts? And it's not that hard to do. Aware. There must be some failing sensation there somewhere. Become aware of any sensations there, give it kindness, and actually feel things relaxing. Mindfulness and kindness, you feel everything get very loose and open and free. Simple, simple technique, but incredibly powerful. So, no research done on it, but I'm pretty confident that, you know, that it would be amazing just to reduce the incidence of breast cancer for women, which is a terrible disease. Can be done. It's really interesting stuff now, because it's important for you. So when you start to be aware of the body and learn how to relax it, it's important. So you actually, it's more likely that you do it. And once you start doing it, mindfulness and kindness are being strengthened. So by the time you've relaxed your body, my body gets so relaxed. You get to a stage of relaxation, which I've only been investigating this last year or two, we call that the delight for relaxation. The body feels just so happy, so peaceful. It's a pleasure of relaxation. And I realize that's the same pleasure which people pay a lot of money for when they go to places like Bali or the Maldives, some resort where they can go on these recliners, put their feet out in the sun, and feel just so relaxed. You know, you can see, just get away from it all, relax in Bali. You don't need to go to Bali or Broome Cable Beach Resort or the Great Barrier Reef. Come to Jhana Grove Meditation Resort. Because you can relax deeper. Because you're the mindfulness, the awareness, and the kindness, and the whole body just relaxes so deeply. And you get this perception of delight. Body feels really nice. Sometimes you haven't had enough money to go on those resorts. It's like when you wake up in the morning, and you don't have to get out of bed. You feel really cozy. You know, you don't have to go to the toilet. That's a problem with old people like us. But you don't have to go to the toilet, you know, you're just sitting there, just cozy, just an extra few minutes, because it feels nice. That is the pleasure of relaxation. And you get that in this beginning part of meditation, awareness, kindness, and the pleasure of it. And the thing which I noticed, I never realized until about a year ago, when you actually perceive the pleasure of relaxation, you get more relaxed. The relaxation goes deeper. It's as if, like, your mind notices, oh, this is nice. I'm going to have more of this. And your body relaxes even deeper, only when you notice its delight. And of course, that was an interesting phenomenon. I thought, hey,
That's exactly what happens later on in your meditation, sitting meditation. When you notice how delightful the breath is, the breath gets more soft and easy. When you notice how delightful the nimitta is, the nimitta develops. Perception of delight is actually really, really important in the meditation part, which I may describe later on. But now, just the very beginning, when you're meditating, you sit down, feel your body. Choose to. This is effort, okay? You're doing something. I admit that. Do something, but at the very beginning, choose to be aware of your body and relax it. What does it need? 5 minutes at least. Adjusting the body so it really feels well. Is that really good? Can I adjust anything else? Anything needs scratching? Loosen the belt, loosen the sort of a zip on your jacket, whatever. Make yourself nice and warm. Really get into this. 5 minutes of caring and awareness. Another 5 minutes afterwards, not moving, but being aware of inner parts of your body, and just experimenting, try and affect care. How can this feeling get more relaxed? The mindfulness indicator, this time relaxation, bodily relaxation, say of your liver. You know, people who have liver disease and other diseases, you can feel the liver. I don't care if it's imaginary or not, but you feel something. Now, that gives you the opportunity of getting feedback. Does it feel more comfortable or more tense? And that indicator will teach you how to relax. I do this and it gets more relaxed. Do it again, more relaxed. Do it again, more relaxed. It gets relaxed and relaxed and relaxed. And that way you can relax parts of your body you thought you never had any connection with before. I mentioned that earlier with that monk who had the muscles on either side of his spine. He even became aware of those so he could exercise them. Here I'm talking about relaxing, not exercising. But it still worked for him. It made them strong. I want to make yours healthy. So 10 minutes of body work, basically mindfulness and kindness, till your body gets so relaxed and so peaceful. And then you can let it go. But when you actually go inside, as I was saying with the simile of the lotus, then you get to sort of the mental world. But you've developed the two abilities of what mindfulness is and kindness is. So it's pretty strong by this time. So when you're watching the past and future, it's much easier to learn how to relax the past and relax the future. And you know what I mean by relaxing the past, relaxing the future. Many people, what do you mean relaxing the past? The past is. What do you mean relaxing or being kind to the future? I can be kind to a cat. I can be kind to my lover. I can be kind to myself sometimes. Be kind to something like the future. What the heck does that mean? Because you develop the kindness already, you just put it onto the future. You're kind to it. It softens and relaxes. And the future becomes so velvety instead of hard. It just vanishes. And the past, all these pains and aches from the past, they soften. They're not a problem anymore. Because they're not a problem, you can let them go. And that's how they just use the mindfulness and kindness of the past. And the mindfulness and kindness to your thinking, this poor mind of yours. You give it such a hard time. So I keep on saying, it's okay, mind. I can't ask. You drive me crazy sometimes, mind, but it's okay, I still love you. Okay, come, let's reconcile. So I can be with you, and you can be with me. And that's literally how it works. When you're kind to the mind stays with you. All restlessness. This is a powerful statement, but it's true. Well, if you're thinking too much, still restless, still escaping away. Who are you escaping away from? It's only yourself. Because your relationship to yourself is not that good. Afraid, upset at you. So this is literally reconciling yourself with your mind. And when you like your mind and your mind likes you, that's okay, mind. You know, yeah, you give me some really stupid times, mind. I've actually been quite cruel to you, but let's make up.
So you stay with your mind, which means you don't wander off anywhere. How can you wander off with someone you love and like and really care for? You just want them to be around all the time. And that's me and my mind. We've got such a good relationship. We like each other so much. Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Brahm's mind. So we hang out together. We chill out. You don't have to force it to say, mind, you come over here. Don't wander off. Don't go to the past. Don't go to the future. Don't go to thinking. You stay here. Never say that. My mind sees me coming. It's like a little dog. Runs up to you, wags its tail, licks you. That's my mind. Because we've had such good times together. So that's how it works. So today's talk, basically mindfulness and kindness. Again. But first of all, with the walking meditation, and then with the body. So you start. So work with the body. So you get so relaxed. At the very least, you get incredibly healthy after coming to these meditation retreats. And then also you get some really fantastic happiness in meditation. So there we go. Sadhu! 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 And for those of you who are getting limiters and you're imagining them, here are four from Singapore Airlines, one from Garuda. I'll leave them over here. You can actually get them and just put them on your eyes and see if they work. So you can have this over there. It must be a limiter because you've got the eye shades on. All part of the deal.